Attention, citizens! It's time for Super Pulp Science!
This is Super Pulp Science, where we talk about how genre gets made. I am GMB Kamichak. Don't let all those fancy initials fool you. The G stands for Gregory. And I'm here with my long-suffering co-host, Justin Curry, known the world over as Chasing Artwork. We are professional writers and illustrators and ne'er-do-wells and creative mercenaries. And sitting silently and nodding at us through his perfectly groomed beard is Dan Vaderbunker, our producer extraordinaire.
What's the M stand for again?
Majestic?
No, for M.
Millicent?
Is it really?
No.
Michael.
It's Michael. Yeah.
I would love it for Millicent.
Right? Anyway. I was just, so what are some random M words that aren't my middle name? And those are the two. Whatever that says about me, that those two.
And you started going as GMB as a result of
spite.
your ex job.
Well,
we can talk about spite. I've got some good stuff.
Yeah, well, partly. Okay, so the GMB, as long as we're talking about it, we might as well talk about it. I snuck into and then inculcated myself as a regular participant of Dennis Cooley's Advanced Creative Writing class. And during that time, there's a whole story in there. I wasn't supposed to be there, but I stayed in it.
I think you told that story on the podcast before.
Yeah.
I'm sure you have.
And so there was a person there who shall remain nameless who came to one of the after events, which is basically what would happen is we weren't all done with our conversations and we go out after and people would have a few beers and they would just keep talking about stuff that was not pertaining directly to the writing, but the life that went into the writing, you know, as you kind of, the support group. And there was a person who came to one of those who wasn't in the class, but was said, you know, I hate people who use their initials to sign their work. And I didn't like this person. And so my very next day, when I handed in my story, I put GMB Kamichak.
So your entire brand is
out
because
of
spite.
Partly built out of spite. Yeah. And then a different person was like hating on E.E. Cummings for being lowercase.
Okay.
Like, well, they have their punctuation, but it's all lowercase. And I was like, oh, I'm going to leave the punctuation out as added confusion. And it just became what I did. And then accidentally that became a good idea because in the early days of the internet, since I was a teacher.
Of high school students
in a very conservative school district. Having GMB before the Kamichak put me in a whole different set of searches than Gregory Kamichak,
right.
Teacher.
You were harder to track down.
Yeah, well, you know, it's just because if you write anything at all interesting, conservative people find issue with it, right? As soon as you've hung something on a wall, you've offended somebody. As soon as you've written your opinion, someone is offended. And in those early days, in your young, you know, when you're 20 and stupid and you think like, oh, no one will ever find out, you do things like that.
I can't stop thinking about OnlyFans. I don't know why.
You can't stop thinking about OnlyFans?
Well,
I know why you can't
Justin.
Stop thinking about OnlyFans, Justin. Yeah, that's a whole other thing.
OnlyFans has zero of my money, but there's all those stories, right, of the high school students finding...
Oh, you know, finding the teacher.
Finding the
yeah.
teacher's
yeah.
OnlyFans.
Yeah,
right?
And I definitely have a story like that where a student said, you know, what can you tell me about the Imagination Manifesto in class? And I was like, oh, you know, I see you have access to the internet.
Good for you. You can search.
Yeah.
Anyway, go on. So that was it. That was all the GMB,
yeah.
And you just stuck with it.
So, and then there was another part of it was, you know, it's sort of silly, but as I'm forming as a writer and I'm doing more self-archaeology and learning about the family lineage, the fact that those initials are named from family members who are now gone. It was like a way to, like, if I include them, then I'm including them on the journey. Like, you're gone, but you're still here, and I owe it to you, and my parents thought enough about you to name me after you, so let's just keep bringing you along on the journey.
Yeah.
And so,
that's nice.
Yeah, it started as youthful spite, and then it was maintained out of a simmering wisdom. Is that what you would say?
No.
And to that person,
simpering, maybe, instead?
To that person who says they hate initials, authors with initials, I mean, I've talked to a lot of female authors who say they have to do it that way
right.
because there are inherent sexist people who will not buy books from female authors. So they use their initials so that their gender is not revealed.
Yeah.
And that's a real problem, and it sucks, but it's why it's so common, I think.
Yeah.
Right?
Or fake names as well, right?
But also, come on.
Yeah.
J.R.R. Tolkien did it first and best. Well, he didn't do it first, but I think did it best.
What does the RR stand for?
It's Ron... Let's back up and let's look really wise.
You know, let's cut out the part where he doesn't know J.R.R. Tolkien's initials.
Yeah, look up his initials quick. Ronald Rule. I knew it was Rule. Ronald Rule. John Ronald Rule. Yeah.
They made a movie about him recently.
I think yeah. And you know, it's actually fine if you leave in our confusion, because in a way that's kind of the idea.
Yeah.
You know less about them actually if the initial is there. Mm-hmm. And who they are as a writer is less important than the work anyway.
True.
You know?
And honestly, when a writer becomes more important than the work, then that's then we get into a J.K. Rowling situation. And
yeah.
The work suffers because of it, right?
So yeah, another initial.
Yeah.
Another initial holder in the writing world. So yeah. So I guess what this is now talking about in a tangential way is something that Justin thought we should discuss earlier, which is when your ideas are jealous of each other. This is a jealousy. I think this person's comment about I hate writers who really was a jealousy of writers who.
That's right. I mean, coming from somebody in a writer's workshop, speaking about writers who are, I guess, assume more successful than they are,
yeah.
There's going to be jealousy there for sure.
And if all criticism comes from a place of insecurity, as I think it does, even my criticism of that person comes from my insecurity of the choice of deciding to pick a non-standardized way to choose my name. There is a little bit of that, because every now and then the CBC will call me up, or I'll be on the Canadian broadcast, and they will start with Goomb. Like they they just leak, they go all in on it. Like, this
oh
must
boy.
Be your name.
That's just not good. That's just poor practice.
Right?
I think.
This can, must be your
supposed
name.
Supposed to ask them at the beginning, how do I see your name?
That's right. And so then I have to explain it. So it does lead to some confusion, but maybe that obfuscation is, you know, in a way fun or interesting. But ideas compete with each other. And Justin and I were talking about this, not related to how we name ourselves, but as long as we're on that topic, chasing artwork rather than Justin Curry is how you built your brand.
Yeah, which
but
is
it's just you.
We've yeah. talked about that before.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a result of graphic design training. We talk about branding a lot, and branding packages, and having a logo, and having a like a set identity. As we become graphic designers, and a lot of people choose to just use their name and come up with some kind of typography solution with their name, but I always liked the idea of being represented by something a little bit more than myself, like a studio name. And I can't exactly remember when it started, but at some point or another, like all through my creative career, that first page in the sketchbook is always a lot worse than the last page in the sketchbook, right? You're always getting better. The more, and especially with, like, that's true across all disciplines, but especially in art, it's very evident that drawing, if you decided you wanted to get good at drawing bears, and you started drawing bears today, a couple months from now, you're going to look at those first bears and you're going to hate them.
Because you'll add technology, and then there'll be bears with technology.
And then you'll bears with technology. But you'll get so much better. So you're always, that practice is very, very evident. That progression is very, very evident. And so then it became this idea. It's like, well, then that'll never end. As long as you're chasing your best pieces, you're never going to arrive. You're never going to finish. You're always going to be practicing. So you're always chasing.
So as it became a mission statement. See,
yes.
I had other company names, and I've had other company names, and I've had companies before. And I can never settle on a name for long enough that I love it enough. And maybe the reason is that I never made the mission statements.
Well,
I tried to make them like icons.
That's the other part of this. Like that was one of the things I remember. Like, it was very drilled into us that you're going to work for companies, you're going to work for yourself, and you're going to have a brand, and you are going to eventually hate that brand because you have to look at it every day.
Mm-hmm.
You have to think about it 100 times more than anybody else. Mm-hmm. Do not change that brand, because rebranding you should only do when you are drastically changing your business or if something really scandalous has happened.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Companies will update their brands, but they will not rebrand unless something terrible has happened or they're starting from the ground up.
You want to hear something really nutty? I heard of a couple guys that want to build something called an airplane. You know, you get people to go in it and they fly around like birds. It's ridiculous, right? Or what about breaking the sound barrier, or rockets to the moon, or atomic energy, or a mission to Mars? Science fiction, right?
And so that idea of like once I choose something, I need to stick with it, mm-hmm. I think has really paid off. Because in the early days of chasing artwork, I like hum and ha, like maybe there's like something with shattered in it would be better. Maybe something more robotic would be better. But I stuck with it. And then 10 years into my artistic career, people don't know me at shows as Justin. They know it. That's the chasing guy. It's the chasing artwork guy. It's the Willow. It's the chasing artwork guy. The branding has paid off because I didn't follow that instinct of I'm sick of this logo and I want to change it. I want to switch it up. I want to be different.
So when we poison you and start wearing your skin to shows, we don't have to worry about anyone knowing too much about you as a person. We'll be able to just be the chasing
guy. There's a good majority of people who still think my name is Chase.
Oh, I know. Yeah. I love how you don't correct them. You just say, good to see you too.
Yes.
Well, and it's what those a lot of conversations with people that like I got your name at some point, but I don't remember anymore. Right. And so I can't return with their proper name either. Mm-hmm. And they probably don't remember my name. They're just looking at, oh, I think its name is Chase because chasing artwork.
Yeah.
So pursuant to our actual notion that we're going to do here, which is the idea of jealousy of your own ideas and the competing ideas, your one idea competing for another. Yeah. This is why I don't have a brand and why I decided not to have.
You do now, though.
But a company name related to what I do. I've settled on GMB Kamichek. We've designed a little icon for it. Credit where it's due. The idea for the design was Justin telling me what it should be. And I went away and did it. But when he looked at me and was like, idiot, it's obviously your little tripod. Like, that's what it should be.
Idiot? Did he really say idiot?
Yeah, it was harsh. It was pretty harsh.
I'm looking for it right now, but it is quite brilliant. Yeah. I should compliment you. I noticed that almost immediately. I think the first thing I noticed it on was your first beer label for Comic Con last year. Yeah. I'm like, oh, that's pretty clever. Yeah.
So what that came down to was, because my name is hard to pronounce and hard to spell, if I have an image that's related to it and use that image over and over, then I can play both sides of that fence. And then the idea of I have lots of different things I do, and I write and I illustrate, and I write and illustrate as a separate thing. Those are sort of the three legs of the tripod, and like that all kind of fit together as my mission statement as an icon. But because sometimes I want to write a play, and sometimes I want to write a horror story, and sometimes I want to write a kid's book, and sometimes I couldn't settle on one brand identity.
That's why you need to do something a little broad. So just your name, right? Like all those things you just listed, your logo, your brand fits on all those very easily.
And my name also is the through line.
Yeah,
and so that's the only.
It's good that you didn't say like, my brand is Gregory Kamichuk, the kids book illustrator who's good at kangaroos. You know, don't do that.
Oh
dude,
man, those ruse and I. Oh, man, it's the pouches.
Try to keep it broad, but
ew.
Yeah.
No, Dan.
Well, I don't know. They're gross, aren't they? Oh, the pouch is kind of gross.
Kangaroo OnlyFans guy. Here.
Oh,
what's happening?
Okay, that was weird.
Weird is my brand, actually.
Yes.
Okay, but going to this statement that, and I think this happens to me around this time every year. So we've been doing a lot of school visits as well. So I think we should talk about school visits in this somewhere. But our convention season wraps up around November and starts up around now. Like February to March, shows start to pop up again, and from November until February, we usually take time to make new projects, new books, and we're not really going out, we're not presenting them, so they're all kind of like we're in a hibernation state just making new work. Mm-hmm. And that's always really exciting because it's you don't have as many distractions, you don't have as many trips. This year I kind of took that huge chunk just to work on my project Spark Chasers, which I've been talking about a lot on the podcast, still really excited about, it's still coming along, the excitement for that project is still very much there. But now that's I've kind of wrapped up where I wanted to get with that book's progress, it's still a lot to do, but now I'm moving on to, I have a whole bunch of posters and other projects that I wanted to get ready for the convention season.
And you're also writing your first novel.
I'm also writing a novel, and I have a couple other things, but now that it's February, events are starting up, and it's I Love to Read Month, so I've done 4 or 5 schools in the last couple weeks, and I have more coming up. And so I'm being productive, I'm being time efficient, but even when I'm being time efficient, like yesterday, I'm working on a new piece based off the show Primal. If you haven't seen it, amazing show. So I'm working on this, and I'm getting lots done, but the whole time I still have this anxiety because there's four other paintings that I've also started that also want my attention. And so there's this guilt and anxiety that I'm not getting enough done, but I am getting stuff done.
And the Diaries Kickstarter.
And the Diary, like, I should be working on that too. And yeah. that. So there's, it's not that I'm not being productive. It's just that I have too many options and they all want my attention. And I find it kind of stressful.
Yeah, I go through that a lot. I've also been doing a lot of school visits. And it's, as I said, it's I Love to Read Month. And so, you know, you can't be what you can't see. We try to get in front of as many students as we can and just say, like, imagination is important. It'll help you thrive in all the areas of your life, whether you're a creative person or not. So here's some ways to do it. And a very common question that I got asked, and I've been visiting classrooms from grade 2 all the way to grade 12. How do you finish so much work? And I think I was surprised that this answer surprised people. So. It developed over the course of visiting all these classrooms into the following way of explaining it. I would simply write, before anyone came in, I would write on the board the name of every project that is currently in development, either in my sketchbook, in the studio, whatever. And there was about 25, either an idea or a poem or a short story or a long story or a novel draft or a script or a, you know, whatever it was, I just put them all on a list. And when people say, how do you finish things? I point at the cloud and I would say, I don't finish anything. I just procrastinate on finishing things by only going to the pile of stuff I want to do. So if I'm not going to work on this one, I have to work on one of these ones. And eventually, that work piles up until things get finished. I rarely am able to say, here is a solid deadline that I will finish this self-initiated project by.
That eventually happens. Yeah. As time goes on, as an event comes up, then you can kind of start to prioritize.
Right. Those all become external pressures. Yeah. So your collaborator is a great external pressure. Yeah. We need to get this finished by this time so that I can do the part of the work that I need to do. Bam, now it moves it way up in the queue. Mm-hmm. So I can procrastinate. And I have sort of three or four different things that I'm doing right now which are at the top of the queue. And what they all have in common is there's a collaborator attached. So if I am going to not work on this one, I'm not going to go down the list to something that's just all about me because I'm leaving those people in the lurch. I'm going to cycle around. So Errol yeah. Gordon, if you're listening to this, you're on that. You're right near the top of that list, right? Working on stuff for Blood Letters. Zach Schuster working on stuff for right? Jonathan Ball working on stuff for Last Breeds and for Eye Collector. Even Justin tinkering on stuff for Oldest Salt, Strong as the Sea, right? So like these kinds of things are cycling. But when I absolutely have nothing for any of those, I will still get anxious if I'm not doing something. That jealousy of the idea clamoring to be alive means that I'll just flip to a page of my sketchbook and I usually just doodle some aspect of some new thing.
See, that's part of something I'm kind of keeping track of in my brain and being aware of is as I'm coming up with more and more things that I want to do, personal projects, I think like animosity to anybody else who wants to work with me.
Or, yeah, stuff, I know. Like, I starts get that to feeling raise, sometimes like, too, yeah.
My time, like I want so much of my time. My ideas want so much of my time. You coming in and saying, hey, mm-hmm. also this, all those ideas, like hackles go up, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you have to be... You know, it's the room of one's own, but you have to build those rooms in your own head sometimes. And if you are a person, in any walk of life, if you're a person busy doing things, other people will assume you can handle one more thing.
Yeah.
Right? Ask any busy stay-at-home parent. Everyone sees them capable of doing all this stuff, so they're quick to ask them to do one more thing. Come and be part of this parent committee also, or whatever. Mm-hmm. This is not related exclusively to the creative life. If you are getting stuff done, everyone wants some part of that. And you know, we're doing, you know, I've been wearing a lot of hats lately, from movie producer to music producer of all things, to, you know, like all of these kinds of ideas are just because if I don't do them, they won't happen. And I want to see that thing exist. And so if I don't put some energy into it, it won't exist.
Won't manifest.
And why else are we here? Like, we're not just here to consume bullshit from other people, right? We have to use this life, which is so brief and so present now and unique now, to do something with it, you know?
The question that I'm asking is this. Are we happier as a human race? Is the world fundamentally a better place because of science and technology?
Is part of the stress, part of the anxiety, part of the pressure comes from just the nature of social media and the internet? You see other creatives. A lot of them aren't on your radar until they finish something. And it's like, oh, look at all the work so-and-so has done. Yeah. Look at that amazing project they just finished. I don't have an amazing project like that yet. But they haven't been, you know, they've been silent up until that point. And now you feel like they're getting so much done because they finally launched,
right? I have an interesting counter feeling about social media lately. I feel no jealousy whatsoever from the noise people are putting onto social media. Where I feel that pressure is from books that lasted 200 years, right? Nothing that we're throwing as noise into the world right now on these video feeds will last 200 years. The media just will not last that long. And that somehow there's this weird squiggles on paper that have outlasted all those different kinds of things, right? Think of all the different kinds of recording devices that we've got, and still books overshadowing them.
That just makes me think of, I recently heard about a time capsule that was buried, I believe it was in Flushing Meadows, New York, and they did it during a World's Fair or something like that, and it was in the 50s, and they buried this time capsule, and they had like the entire history of the world, and it was meant to be opened in 5,000 years. They said that, do not open this for 5,000 years.
And they cracked it open? No.
Okay. But it was just a story about it, and about like it was like 50th anniversary or whatever, right. They had done it. So they did this, and... they said, but they put the entire history of the world on microfilm. Right. And then they also included instructions on how to build a microfilm reader.
Just in case
they didn't have microfilms anymore. And well, that was immediately, I'm like, that's almost immediately outdated.
Well, consider the following, right? A large majority, I won't quote stats to you, but a large majority of the technology that brought people to the moon the first time is no longer available to us because the manufacturing that went into it is no longer part of what we do.
Yeah.
And so that technology is now gone and needing to be reinvented.
That's why they're having so much trouble going back there.
Going back to the moon, right? If private companies are getting back by sending robots because sending rockets is so much more difficult than it used to be.
Yeah.
And so some things that we have dug up 10,000 years later are little squiggles on tablets of clay that have outlasted all the technologies of those things. And so it's just the pressure that I feel, just coming back around to it, to like the jealousy of the idea.
When you take a step back.
Is that when I take a step back and I'm sitting, you know, I feel very fortunate that I have a library at home and it's got, you know, a couple thousand books in it. And the books that I love, some I've read and some I haven't. And I've worked through them. And every time I pick up a book that I've said to myself, one day I'll read this and I might give a shit. And then I do. And it's an old work. Most recently, like Lord Dunsany's The Fortress Unvanquishable Save Sacknoth. I've been obsessed with this story lately. I've been reading it. And it's, you know, 130 years old. And it's considered one of the first sword and sorcery stories ever written. And in the body of this person's work, none of his other writing is like it. And it is so unique and different. And it has lasted. And it has... continued. And when I read it, my son said, you know, can you read me a story before bed, you know? And he's a teenager, so these are rare events now. And so I was like, absolutely. He said, read me something that would surprise me. And so I pulled out this story and I'm reading it, and it has a little like twist in the language and a few different phrasings, like subject and predicate are in odd places in the language. And he goes, when was this written? This story is awesome. When was this written? And when I told him, he was like, that is amazing. Can you imagine coming up with a story this weird and then people finding it and reading it 130 years, 150 years later? He's like, and he's not a famous author in the sense of like J.K. Rowling. No one made movies of his work because movies didn't exist.
Right.
No one didn't make billions of dollars off of his work because billions of dollars didn't exist. Right?
I think it's almost
just the idea lived.
Yeah.
Probably like he wrote a lot of things, right? It's almost a bit of a lottery. Like the book that you might be, that might last 200 years is probably not the one you think is going to be, right?
I'd recommend The Highwayman or Lord of Cities also by him. It's two short stories that are fantastic. Okay. But all this to say, it's right there in his name how he pulled it off. Lord. Right? Right? Jonathan is yelling from the side. He's relegated to the dusty corner to finish
his last podcast.
Yeah, he had his podcast. He said they made some movies out of the
They did make some movies.
Well, they make movies out of every book. They'll make movies out of anything. But you're right. No, you have something to say about you're right. A lot of this stuff that's being put out there, especially in the digital form, is not going to be even readable by future civilizations because it's all going to kind of degrade.
Someone said it to me recently. It was my dad. He was like, "Oh, it's like radio. You would listen to a great radio show. No one recorded that. That's over."
Yeah, right? Radio's dead.
Right? No, but I mean, like from his youth.
Yeah.
Right? Because he's born in 1940, so he was in this golden age of radio, right? And they don't have the recordings of some of the greatest conversations, the greatest moments, the greatest. Yes. Those just happened and they're gone now.
Yes.
That's social media now. It's happening, but it'll soon be gone and no one will ever be able to know that it happened the way you think they'll know that it happened.
Yep. I mean, the radio signals are still traveling out into space.
Yeah, that's a good point. You can travel faster than light and then catch them.
Okay.
Right.
That'd be an interesting story, eh?
That would be cool. Yeah. That's a good sci-fi premise.
Yeah.
A spaceship,
catching
a
the radio.
Yeah, catch a traveling spaceship. Well, we should storyboard
but specifically
that. Catching a radio wave
to catch a specific radio signal.
Okay. Yeah.
Now that's where it would be at. The fine granule of that is they have to.
They're chasing. They need information from this very specific radio
from the
signal.
Specific person, time, place, and they have to get to the place that it would be in
scouring
the universe.
The ocean of space for that
one
signal.
Shit, I'm writing that down. That's great.
Some story breaking happening.
Radio. Signal chase.
What could be so important?
What could be so important from the past?
I think of explorers when the aliens just watch TV and learn everything about us from the day the Earth stood still.
I know what you're going to say. Is that one of the first transmissions into space is unfortunately
Hitler.
Yes.
That's from Contact.
Contact.
Does anybody speak German?
I declare the games in Berlin at the celebration of the first Olympics of the new era is open.
So, when ideas are competing.
There's another one to compete with all the other ones.
Right. When ideas are competing in your head, it's not unlike the ideas competing on social media. Everyone has a voice. And in your own head, you've got all these different voices of all these different projects. And it can also be the voice of your relationship. Like this, you know, example I just gave. My son, who is, you know, he's adolescent now. Right, he's on the verge of adulthood, is on the horizon, he can see it. Him saying to me, "Dad, will you read me a story tonight?" And it's way, like it's 10 o'clock, it's time for bed, you got school in the morning, is a competing idea. The idea is there are responsibilities, you should go to sleep, you should get up early, you have to be ready for school. But the other competing idea is how many times in my life as a father is my son going to ask me to read him a story?
Or rather, how many more times, right?
That's right. Not that many more. And so I just said yes, went up there. And I could, my wife, who had already gone to bed, I heard her get up and I heard her walk over to like tell us like, no more video games, no more TV. Like sometimes we get into a little, like we'll get into a little tumble and it's way past our bedtime. And I could tell from her footfalls, which were quieter going away. Like, oh, I get it. Yes, these are rare moments. Carry on. Carry on, husband. This is okay. I endorse it. Her quiet walk away endorsed the entire thing. And so those are those competing ideas.
Okay, so on the other end of that spectrum, when you have that huge cloud of ideas, are there some of those ideas that are not that precious and maybe you should let die?
Yeah, that's what I've been asking myself. It's like on this list of things.
This was so exciting when I came up with it, but since I came up with it, there's 10, 11 other things.
So can I tell you something
that are more exciting
that I think you may find terrifying? Mm. I've been going through this idea recently of, okay, I have all these novel drafts and story drafts that I thought I would finish, but maybe I don't. And I found a bunch of them in my Google Drive, and I said, okay, for once and for all, I'm going to print some of them off, and I'm going to read them and be done with them.
And it's been so long since you wrote them, you won't even...
2004.
Oh, God.
Right?
Yeah.
20 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's okay that they'd be dead. But they've been occupying space in my head as, like, unfinished, right? And I've been trying to let go of things. They're like, oh, well, I don't have time for these things. Those were fun adolescent ideas. And then I reread some of them, and I was like, oh, I could fix this up. It was the opposite effect. I thought I'd be able to let it go. And now
it's reintroduced to the RAM.
It's reintroduced, and now I have one more thing to do in the RAM. And it was a bad mistake to revisit it. I should have just let it die. But part of why it stays as a competing idea is our habit recently. You and I have a similar habit. When we start a new sketchbook, we go through the last sketchbook and we collect the unfinished ideas and we bring them forward and we think, you know, it's like a tinkering space.
A lot of them are like they go through modifications, right? The original idea, I find, and I talked about this a lot in my school visits, how every movie you see, every book you see, there are dozens of versions of that story that never see the light of day. And writing is rewriting, and stories need to go through iterations, and ideas need to go through iterations, and that's really important. And that's why I think it's really important. Like in our books, we often show the behind the scenes, like the terrible sketches
that's what this podcast
started.
Is,
that's right? What this podcast is, right? A look behind the sausage counter.
Yeah. Don't look there.
Mix some metaphors there.
Right. So what I was going to say related to that is, I print out some of these drafts, I'm reading the ideas, and some of these ideas had been haunting me because the lingering character or a bit has actually gone 20 years through my sketchbooks and has not gone away. I'm still doodling that same mask or that same
still
character.
Still holding
thing,
on to it.
Still holding on. So I was like, I'm finally going to be done with this. I was, you know, I'm getting ready. You know the drill. I'm getting ready to start the new sketchbook.
I'm
just on the last few, so I'm figuring out what I'm going to bring forward. And I actually told myself, I'm going to let some of this go. As I wrote all those all those things on the boards for the students, I was like, dude, this is a madman's list.
Right.
Right? Just let some of this go. And I was I said that to some of the classes also, like, I'm realizing as I write this, this is not the way to do it, people. Like, this is the way I do it, but I don't think this is a replicatable model if you want to be a sane person. Don't do this and then also drink and do drugs or you're doomed, right? Like, it's only because I have certain limiters in my life and I've managed to control those others, so I have space for this madness. So I'm a little feeling trapped now by some old ideas that I wasn't even jealous of. They were just like little like sounds far away that are much louder and closer than they used to be because I was trying to get rid of those ideas. And I'm not sure what that means. Help me, Jeff. Help me. How do you deal with
it? Well, like I wanted to bring up, like, so I recently did the Vancouver Comic Fan Expo was my very first show of the year. Mm-hmm. And I was going into it, I had like three or four ideas for new pieces I was really, really excited about. But I knew I should hold on to those ideas and see what happens once I'm back in the artist's alley surrounded by my friends and peers who have been working hard since I last saw them.
Yeah, yeah. Let the cross-pollination happen?
Yes, that inspiration, which just is a fancy word for jealousy, rear up and see what happens. And that's exactly what happened. I was exposed to all these new projects and new art that I hadn't seen yet. And it prompted like four full pages of thumbnails for new pieces. And a lot of it, there were pieces that I kind of like, I was half into, and some things that I saw at other booths clicked the missing puzzle pieces into place. Like, oh, that idea I had, if I look at it through this lens and do it in this format, then it works a lot better.
Yeah.
And so it took a whole bunch of back burner projects and made them scream for attention.
See, I wrote in 1 hour and 30 minutes, we wrote an episode of television with a writer's room, quote unquote. It was a grade 12 classroom, and I just put them through the writer's room paces, and we broke off and all did scenes and put all this stuff together. And they were so surprised by how, quote unquote, easy it was to get a draft together in an hour and a half. But I pointed out, well, we've been actually working for 24 hours. There's 24 of us in the room, and we're all doing that 1 hour of labor. So we've got 24 hours of labor. And so we've skimmed all the good ideas off of 24 hours of labor, and that's what's made it onto the board, and that's what's made it onto our page. And that's why the writer's room works so effectively.
Yeah.
You are in the artist's room in that same way.
Hundreds of years worth of work.
Other people's work that are giving you the fill in the gaps part. And if you go to a museum, you know, I'll never forget, it was a formative part in just me as a person being in the Hermitage in St. Petersburg, this room after room after room of masterpieces. And that's that same feeling. You just sit down with your sketchbook and you realize, oh, that's how you solve all these different problems. And they're all around you, all the solutions, right? All the final calculus is there. And you just have to copy down the answers, basically. So Comic-Con is like that now in the modern age, where everyone is bringing their best idea that they've got in the last year. And it's very current, right? It's if it's there, it's either survived the last bunch of years because people want it.
Yeah.
You know, you can say what you want about capitalism, but it does turn one idea against another to see if attention warfare, who's going to win that. So if it's lasted and then the new piece is out, you can see that there's so much. The German word for it is Gestalt, right? All those ideas coming together into one sort of solid
I prefer
form.
To say Gestalt.
Gestalt.
Control, if you're reading me, I am all okay to go. Okay to go.
85%.
All bearing tips are on the profile.
There's a not so nice part of that too, of like we're starting to see...
Hating everyone?
No. The
oh, I know.
Like the artist alley has gone from like this dinky little part of the show to a huge part, to some of these artists have massive booths and clearly are doing quite well.
Some of these artists some of have these massive artists. Booths. Yeah,
and then companies coming in, right?
Oh.
And like, oh, okay, there's money to be made here. Let's look at what these guys are doing and let's make a business out of it.
Let's become middlemen.
And so more and more, there's more and more vendors that just hire, not hire artists, but like get the licenses to print and sell their work, and just kind of, we can do it on a bigger scale and with better margins and have a bigger booth. That part, like, I don't know, makes me a little sad.
Side hustle culture is just like sliding in, like, oh, I can have my own business built around someone else's excellent skill sets.
But I guess
and I'm going to be the manager. I went to business school, so I'm going to manage you. That's what you really need is a manager.
That's how companies work, right? Like you see an existing idea that they're doing well, you copy what they're doing and you do it better, right? Like I don't have to come up with it from scratch. I can look at your homework, improve upon it and do the same thing, and now I'm the bigger fish.
It's
right?
Just Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
You didn't think to what was it? What's the line? You were so excited to see if you could. You didn't think to stop.
Yeah.
You should.
It made me invent a dad pun, my dad pun skills, because I was thinking about iconography and all that iconography, but what you're talking about is iconography. Like, if they can do it, I can do it, right? And so you build this edifice in your own head that, oh, it'd be easy if this lazy... unorganized artists can make a living do this. Imagine if me with my spreadsheets came in to organize this, how much better
exactly.
It could be.
And I guess like I kind of do that too. I'll sometimes go by something at a Comic-Con and like, oh, that's a really cool idea, but executed kind of poorly.
Wouldn't it be better?
I can do my version of that is going to be better. I want to do a better version of it. No.
So then now you're talking about the jealousy of other people's ideas. Knowing what you can do through that lens.
Yeah, with your particular skill set and with your experience, you can take that kernel of an idea that they had and run it through the lens of GMB, and the result will be something completely different. And buttons,
Trying to keep my mouth shut on a film set was really hard from that perspective because... You know, we had been writers, but we were in a producer capacity, and the producer's job is to support the director in their vision, and even if you disagree with it.
But you're also the writers who wrote the script.
But the script is not the literary document of a film, okay. Right? The film is
your
the
part
document.
Is done.
But don't
done.
You feel ownership?
Our part's done.
But you still feel ownership of the ideas, right?
I mean, you do. And so that's what I'm saying. It's hard to keep your mouth shut because you have to partition, right? What they see in the idea and what you meant by the idea isn't the same thing. Mm-hmm. But that's fine. You know, I'm reading a story 130 years old, and I'm probably putting the wrong emphasis on what it means to my son. Well, we're talking about it after. Mm-hmm. It doesn't belong to you once you've finished it. It belongs to everyone, mm-hmm. in a way. And then if it's part of a production chain, it can't survive everybody else's skill set, because their skill set is going to slightly alter it and direct it and poach it and push it. And, you know, if you got the hazers on or if you have the hazers off, it really changes the scene, and that determines whether that line of dialogue got cut. Was the hazer on? So does the delivery look good enough to match the color grade of the last scene? Doesn't even matter if I wrote a good line.
Maybe
it's,
the editor.
Did we turn the hazer on?
What's a hazer?
It fills the room, like, literally with
fog.
Haze.
Oh, yeah.
So that the light can be seen.
That's but then the editor decides the pacing is off and needs to cut that completely.
That's yeah. right.
And it doesn't right? end up in the film.
Yeah. Or they didn't run sound properly, and so you hear the hazer.
Right.
No.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Which was supposed to be off, but it ran instead right. of being turned off. Before we ran sound. Yeah. And so the best delivery is now, you know, and on a really super tight professional set, that's when you see people losing their absolute minds.
Yeah.
Is because they expect that that amateur hour is over. But it's not. It's just too many moving parts.
Yeah.
Right? And it's nobody's fault. And we had a couple of moments on there, competing ideas again, where the set deck has an idea. Set decorator, right, has an idea that they've interpreted in our meeting, and we've done a pre-meeting and preloaded the meeting, and they've directed what they think is our direction. Then the director has a new idea on the spot, communicates it to us, so we make a change in the script. We talk to the performer who is now going to deliver that change, but that change now means the set deck has to change, and so someone's moved the prop, but then set deck has taken a photo to make sure that everything can be reset to first position. They notice it out of place, they reset it to one. Then you roll camera and everything's wrong, but it's everyone's doing their job to the best of their ability.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just in that pressure
it's
cooker
a big
of
pipeline.
Just the yeah. pipeline, you know, mm-hmm. breaks down. And everyone's doing their best. And it's not enough. It's so refreshing to just get back into your own head. It's like what you were saying. I don't need to answer to anyone. I don't want to answer to anyone. I just want to do my idea and deliver it the best I know I can do without any of those surprises.
And I've said this a lot in the last couple of days with the school visits, is I have more ideas than I'll ever be able to get done in a lifetime, which is a little bit freeing at the same time, right? That your excuse for not being able to do every single one of those things that you put in your sketchbook, because it is not physically possible.
I know. I actually had the thought, though, of burning all my old sketchbooks after I went through the thing of, oh, I'll dig up these old things and then they won't haunt
to
me
really
anymore.
To release yourself
yeah, to
from...
To really let myself go. Yeah. And let everyone else go. Like, you don't want... My goodness. When I am gone, they should pack my body in the box and burn all my sketchbooks with me. Otherwise, what a
building
burden that is to somebody else. Fire. Right? You kind of want it all to go. But right. then, would we have any of those other great Dune novels after the fact?
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
We talked about that on the podcast before, how sometimes an idea will hit you and it almost doesn't seem like it's yours, right? Like it just came out of the ether and like, I don't know the origin of this idea, but now I have it and this is a great idea and I got to follow it. The lore that we came up with is that when you die, your unfinished ideas float into the ether and the muses deliver it to other artists, right? That those
you had
ideas
your shot.
That, yeah, you had your shot.
You missed it.
You didn't get that idea done. It doesn't die with you. Some other artist is going to get plunked with it at some point.
Like undelivered mail
yep.
went back to the muses mailing service to spark jealousy in another brain later on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness.
To cause that anxiety of too many things to do in another artist in the future.
Yeah. So dear listener, I just want you to know, you have those things that you want to accomplish and they kind of rattle around in your head and you can't get rid of them. We're all the same. Those people at the shows, at the bookstore, at the Cineplex, on your Netflix streaming, when you see that they've accomplished all this stuff and you say, I wish I had accomplished all this stuff. I have all these unfinished ideas. Everyone has a life full of unfinished, unrealized things. And that's okay. right?
Yeah, the version of you that only has one idea and then does that idea and is done.
Yeah.
That's not, whatever that idea is not great.
Yeah. Or then you might as well be evaporated by an alien ray right after, because what else do you have to
because
offer?
Because the radio waves, did we talk, we talked about them in the podcast. Yeah, the radio waves. Yeah.
Oh, and they're trying to identify.
They're trying to kill us because we're all Hitler.
Right.
So what happens now? We give her a medal?
I'd say at least a healthy grant.
Or what if, okay, so yeah, the Hitler broadcast, right? But what if it's something from the 50s, right? Because during the 50s, there was all kinds of speculative ideas about what the future was supposed to be, and what if one of them is a necessary piece of technology? Maybe they brought a mathematician on, because these things happened on the radio in that time, right? And actual scientists came on and said actual important things
that were really ridiculous.
What if he actually laid out his formula to whatever it was on the radio interview and then never wrote it down, died, and so it's lost? But this formula, this little piece of science and research,
you know, like that story of Einstein's notebooks being thrown away by the cleaning staff, right? He wrote some final thoughts and final calculations and they were thrown away apocryphally. What if some,
who throws out
people who didn't read I guess he wrote them in German. People who didn't read German. So you could have a story like that where like someone says like, oh well, I think he mentioned something about that, you know, on that radio show. It's funny that we can't go.
Yeah.
Right? Funny we can't listen to that. And then someone with their faster-than-light starship says, maybe we can. That's a Star Trek episode, actually.
It is. Yeah, it does, feel like a Star Trek episode.
Data would be like,
I'm surprised they haven't done that in Star Trek. Maybe they have. Anyway.
Catching a radio signal.
Yeah. We can wrap up anytime. We're going.
I can talk forever.
Is something else you want to cover?
Convention things coming up.
Yeah.
What's on the horizon?
Oh.
We've got some exciting, this is always an exciting time of year because the Calgary-Saskatoon trip is coming up, which is usually a road trip for us that includes Calgary, which is one of the biggest Canadian shows, biggest North American shows. And then on the way home, we hit Saskatoon. So we have a couple days in between in which we usually are surrounding ourselves with other workaholics and we come up with more ideas that we don't have time for.
The long drive. We haven't told Lyndon about our long drive plan.
Logistics are getting, there's a lot of people involved, so logistics are a bit of a juggle.
We have to be careful not to come up with too many projects on that drive.
We will. That's how
we'll be careful, or we will come up
with
some new
projects. Yeah, we'll come up with too many projects.
Yeah, that's on the horizon. We're also going to a very important metropolis in Manitoba just this weekend.
Oh, yeah, we have the Brandon Comic-Con.
Yeah, it's not a Comic-Con. It is a gaming convention. Is the Westman
but
Gaming.
It's not the normal one. They have another one in September, August.
Think that's true.
Yeah, so this is, I don't know if this is new or it's been around before or.
And it's a result of some competing ideas. You have family commitments that are
I
in
do,
Brandon.
Yeah.
I have some producer commitments that are in Brandon. And so this gives us an excuse to travel to the city, remain long enough to accomplish those things, and also do a show. So it things align.
It's a lovely city.
Yeah, I actually like Brandon.
Paris of the Prairies.
That's Saskatoon. Careful.
Come on. The ghost of Gord Downie.
Yeah, I know.
Right?
Sorry.
Right? He's going to pull you into the penalty box.
There's also, we talked about this, I just recently did, the name is Doki Doki. The Icon did a one-day event at a new location, new time of year. They had no idea what to expect. We didn't know as vendors and artists what to expect. But it was a one-day show put on by an organization that we really like. And I've done a lot of those shows throughout my career. And sometimes you have a lot of time to open your sketchbook and draw. And sometimes you're swamped. Punk Rock Flea Market, another good example.
Swamped.
You probably brought your sketchbook thinking, I might have a lot of time to draw.
I did. And so, I did not have any time to draw. Yeah.
This Icon, this one-day event experiment, Scott Ford said it best. He was there. He never had a chance to open his sketchbook. We were slammed from opening to close.
Yeah.
And you never know.
May I also say, and now this may seem salty, and it was salty originally, but Justin applied, Scott Ford applied, I applied. I did not make the cut because it was a juried show, but it's not a big enough anime show that there's room for anything on the peripheral, right? And so by curating it really tightly in that one day, it makes it a much better event. If everyone who's looking for manga and anime goes to an anime show that's only one day and I eat up 40 minutes of their time, that's actually disingenuous to the whole event, right? Because my stuff has magical girls and big robots, but it's not anime, right? So same is true of the punk rock flea market. You're not going to look for...
Yeah, I might not. They probably wouldn't accept my portfolio, but you are perfect for that, right?
And so those curated events can be really special and great.
So I think, like, on this, I really recommend, if you're an artist or a writer or creative, like, try out these, like, give those one-day events a chance, because some of them are great. But also recognize, like, I, like, craft sales and make it markets are really not great conducive venues for my particular art. I can sometimes...
You figured that out by doing them.
I tried a bunch, and I can move some of my kids' books, but people are not looking for me there. They're not expecting me there. And the only people I'm really catching are the husbands and kids who are there against their will and are shocked that I'm there at all. You know, so... It's good to try those out. And some people find, you know, they try the Comic Cons, they try the anime shows, and things aren't clicking for them there. And then they do try those craft sales, and holy crap, turns out, you know, this demographic eats my stuff up.
And this is related to the competing ideas, right? Everyone's got an idea of what they think a group of people might like. In psychology, they call it an idiosyncratic social group. Right, and any one of those may like a certain number of things, and the anime crowd is a good example. You can identify what the key features of that idiosyncratic social group are. You can imagine them. They are part of the cliche, but that's for a reason. The same is true for a punk rock show. The same is true for a hard rock show. The same is true for a speculative science fiction convention, right? There are these little pockets. And if you think your work is kind of like close but not all the way, give it a shot.
Yeah.
Right? Give it a shot. They might say no. They might say yes. This has been Super Pulp Science, where we have talked about how genre gets made, but we have also reminded you that your competing ideas, those ghosts in your head, they haunt us all. I'm GMV Kamichuk, encouraging you to join the fight and make comics.